Good evening. Welcome to LSE. I'm very sorry for the delayed start. Will Hutton is on his way. He's very close. He's in a taxi. He's just got out and started walking. So he'll join us, I think, at any moment. So I'm sorry for the delayed start. It's my pleasure to be the chairman of this event this evening. My name's Simon Whitney from LSE Law, and I'm going to try and guide you through this evening's proceedings. As you already know, we're here to discuss and debate some very interesting ideas put forward by the Big Innovation Centre in their interim report called The Purposeful Company. The Big Innovation Centre... Will. Welcome. Difficult journey. Thank you, Will. So, the Big Innovation Centre exists to make the UK a global open innovation hub, to build a world-class innovation ecosystem, to rebalance and grow the UK economy. Their final report on corporate governance, which is due out next month, is going to make a very important contribution to a highly topical current debate about how our largest companies ought to be governed, in whose interests they ought to be run, and how we make senior managers accountable. So clearly this is a very topical issue. It's a matter of huge current public interest. Our Prime Minister, Theresa May, is looking at various reform options in a green paper put out by the government very recently. The Prime Minister has actually made it clear that this is an important part of the government's legislative agenda. So we are going to see some change in relation to corporate governance. How dramatic that change is and what shape it takes, we will soon find out. The question we're going to try and address tonight is what do we want to see in that change, and is there any consensus about how we change the way in which our largest companies are run? So we're very fortunate this evening to have some very distinguished speakers to help us to have that discussion. And first, I want to welcome Will Hutton. Delighted that you made it, Will. Will is co-founder of the Big Innovation Centre. He's its current chair and is a co-author of this report. He's a well-known writer and thinker on politics and economics. He's the author of several books, including the very influential The State We're In, which was published in 1995, and the more recent follow-up, How Good We Can Be. Will's accomplishments are too numerous to list. They include 4 years as editor-in-chief of The Observer, for which he still writes a weekly column. He was executive vice chair of the Work Foundation. He's now principal of Hertford College, Oxford. You may have seen Will recently as captain of his alma mater, Bristol University, on the Christmas edition.
Not
of
proud of that.
University
let's move
change.
On quickly, I think we should.
He looked like he was having fun anyway.
Oh, yeah.
I'm also delighted to welcome Professor Mayer, the Peter Moores Professor of Management Studies at the Said Business School, Oxford University, and former Dean of the School. Professor Mayer is also co-author of this report, as well as many academic papers on corporate governance, corporate finance, regulation, and taxation. His thought-provoking book, Firm Commitment, Why the Corporation is Failing Us and How to Restore Trust in It, was first published in 2013. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Will and Colin to speak for no more than around 30 minutes, and they're going to talk us through the key ideas and the areas around which the Big Innovation Centre is currently developing its final recommendations. And then after that, we'll hear some reactions from a distinguished panel, which I'll invite to join us on stage at that point and introduce you to them then. And after that, we'll get some views and questions from you, and I hope that we can have a discussion around these thoughts and these proposals, and the Big Innovation Centre have made it very clear that they really want public engagement. They really want to hear your thoughts and views on the matters that we're discussing tonight. So that's an important part of this evening as far as we're concerned. If you're on Twitter right now, you can use our hashtag LSEUKPLC. If you tweet a question, I'll do my best to pick it up and raise it with the panel. I should also mention that this event is being recorded, and we do hope to make a podcast available of it available after the seminar. So let's get going. Now, Can we have Will first? Is that okay? Are we going to be able to manage that? Can I just go forward to Will's presentation? Because
you want to go back,
and then we'll go back afterwards. So, do you want to come over here, Will, and introduce us to the Purposeful Company? Thank you. There's a slide clicker. That's just a forward arrow.
Great. It's fantastic to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you very much, everyone, for being here. And actually, I think that Claire, who's on the panel, who's a co-author with me and Colin of this report and others who've been kind of working hard on it, always thought, I think Colin has been plowing this furrow nearly as long. I think we've both been plowing this furrow for a long time, thinking, I was going to say nearly as long as me, but I think I've been plowing it nearly as long as you, actually, Colin. We really take this question fundamentally seriously. The firm in a market economy, capitalist economy, is one of the kind of basic building blocks of how that capitalist economy operates. Its dynamism, its rate of innovation, its rate of productivity, its capacity to create great jobs. Even I think you can go as far as the government in its white paper, on its green paper on industrial policy yesterday, made the point in rather a breathtaking kind of assessment, actually, of not only how poor our record was on productivity, but how poor it was on spatial inequality, which is a preoccupation of Greg Clark, the new business secretary. And I think you can, we argue on the Purposeful Company that many of these inequalities and many of this malperformance of the UK economy has got a lot to do with the architecture of our firms, the way they are run, and the ecosystem in which they operate. And that great firms are most remarkable kind of economic and social organizations. And they're more important now than ever before. It's a firm that marshals, and in a sense is the kind of thinking element in our thinking element in terms of wealth generation, pulling together, computing, all kinds of myriads of kind of knowledge to produce value. And I think let me start with the, as I go through this, there's a whole bunch of slides here. I don't know whether you can see them. Do they work for you? I'm not going to get you to read the, all this text, but I've got some diagrams I want to show you. But the big headline that we argue on the Purposeful Company Task Force, and by the way, it's a group of companies. Kingfisher is one of them. Claire's a non-executive director of Kingfisher. The number of companies, Infosys, asset management companies like Fidelity and Hermes, Innovate UK, the Bank of England, Andy Haldane's been supporting us. So it's quite a kind of encompassing group of organizations that have been kind of thinking this through. And we contest that a great company to deliver this value generation needs to be driven by an animating corporate purpose, a clear purpose. And that purpose, I'll say a few words about that in a second, that purpose is a kind of, it is a, almost a moral, not quite a moral in the sense of high ethics, but almost a kind of moral proposition about what it's on earth to do. It is about trying to better the human condition, and that animates the people who lead it, animates the people who work in it, brings together its stakeholders in the supply chain and actually its owners to drive forward in actually working out how to marshal that information, that knowledge, in the best possible way to deliver value over time. We don't have enough of such purposeful companies. That's the brute truth in Britain. And we think the foregone cost of that every year is anywhere up to £130 billion a year, and cumulatively, that's big potatoes. This is a core element in our thinking that actually, and why the story is more important now even than it was 25 or 30 years ago. Intangibles, which are everything from computer algorithms through brands, through kind of all kinds of digital information, research, all kinds of anything that is that kind of encompasses that kind of intangible revolution. We're living through the digital revolution. Everyone knows artificial intelligence. Everyone knows a story about robotics. Everyone knows a story about what's happening in the human genome, and all of that is intangible, or what economists call intangible. And these graphs just show the investment in intangibles crossed over the investment in tangibles, which is plant machinery, the more orthodox way people think, in 2000. And at the moment, the rate of intangible investment in the economy is nearly twice that of tangible investment. And actually, that means that questions like trust, questions like how you bind people together who hold all this intangible information, how you don't make mistakes. The Big Innovation Center got into this project because we are very committed to open innovation. And our view is that in this world in which there's so much data, so much potential avenues down which a company can go, that you have to be porous, you have to be open, you have to collaborate with others, you have to forge trust relationships. And we quickly came to the conclusion that it's purposed companies that actually have that capacity better than non-purposed companies, better able to build those trust relationships. Well, so that's why we try to get this coalition of companies and interest groups together. What is purpose? There's four kind of headings under which we think about purposefulness. Purpose is not just being customer-centric or putting the customer kind of at the center of your kind of thinking. A purposeful company has a covenant with its customers. There's a real sense that you're going to look after these folk over time. You need them. You want their repeat business. You want a relationship with them. You're not going to abuse them. They're central to your business model. Your employees, you have a reciprocal obligation with them. You want them to share your purpose. You want to pay them fairly. You want them to be engaged. You want them to give of their all at work. And actually, because that's the way that you want them to behave, you actually have a kind of explicit and implicit contract with them. They're a member of the organization, they're a member of the firm. They're not actually notations on a spreadsheet to be disposed of at will. There's a mutuality of interest between great purpose companies and the society of which they part. They actually recognize social obligations. They believe in issues like sustainability. And lastly, they really do believe one way or another in trying to contribute to human betterment. And we put together, you're not going to read this from where you are, but it's on the interim report is on the on our website, and do look it up. It's actually in chapter one. But this is a little typology we try to generate about what kinds of purpose great purpose companies use. Either they make a claim to kind of offer everyone an experience that only a few have, and one of our task force members, Kingfisher, would make that claim about their relationship to DIY. Tata want to make very cheap cars for every Indian. Innovation to go where Noah's gone before, that would be Tesla, obviously, but you're trying to position yourself as someone on the frontier. You're going to take on the big guys, and you're going to incorporate fresh challenges. There's a cluster of companies who kind of organize their purpose in those terms. You're going to be the best at what you do. That could be Bang & Olufsen, that could be even the BBC. You take your global responsibilities really seriously. GSK, pharma company, Nestle, I think, would want to make that claim now after their scandal with milk 25 years ago. Human values. You are a company which actually recognizes the humanity of your stakeholders. And again, a cluster of companies, a Japanese company we put up there, Toyota, along with John Lewis. Six categories in which you can think about the way companies declare their purpose and then try to live it. What we do in the interim report is we show beyond peradventure, and I think it's one of the and the and a bunch of folk who kind of know this stuff, and I imagine there'll be some critics and some. But this, I hope, that those who are evaluating what we've done will agree that our pulling together of the evidence that demonstrates that actually one way or another, purpose companies outperform their non-purpose peers. Their share price does better. They are more valuable innovators. Their cost of capital is lower. They retain people. They have less adversarial industrial relations on metrics on which you'd want a company to behave well. Purpose companies tend to be at that end. And on average, they outperform every year their non-purposed or less purposed peers by 5 to 7%. And over a decade, that really starts to mount up. Here is a demonstration of that by Professor Bob Eccles at Harvard, who over the last 25 years has looked at his metric for purposes. These are all companies that take sustainability one way or another very seriously, and you can see how they outperform a control group of companies that don't do that. Moving on quickly, I mean, why are there so few purpose companies in Britain? And the heart of that is that owners don't take their ownership obligations as seriously as they might. They don't commit to corporate purpose. Their relationship with their management teams is highly transactional. And the British ecosystem, what it obliges companies to do, directors fiduciary obligations, insistence that a company is something to be traded on a stock market rather than actually look for ways in which you can get owners to commit to a company over time. And that's a whole bunch of factors which actually make it harder in Britain to get owners to commit to a purpose over a period, compared even with the United States. We often talk about Anglo-Saxon capitalism, but actually what became clear to us doing this work is that actually in many respects the United States looks closer to Germany or Japan than it does to Britain. And and one of the things that we got very interested in was this lack in the UK of block holders. That's to say, part of your shareholder base who actually hold a critical mass of your equity. And if you look at this graph here, which is quite and in many respects this is the most telling graph we put together, and I hope you can see it. What you'll see is this is the proportion of your shares that are actually owned by a few number of shareholders. And if you want, it's much easier if you've got 6, 7 non-affiliated, not a family owner, not necessarily a government owner. We're critical of Volkswagen in that respect, who have blockholders. But if you have non-affiliated blockholders, they will be very effective in actually committing to the company over time, asking tough questions, sticking with it, and being part of actually the way it chooses to invest, and actually delivering lower cost of capital. And you want to be in the top right-hand quadrant and not the top and the bottom left. And you can see where the UK lies. We are the outlier of advanced industrialized countries. We have more dispersed, more anonymized, more transactional kind of shareholding base, our companies do, than any other country, including the United States. It's easier to buy a company here than anywhere in the world. That's why, I mean, they were concerned that Arm was taken out just last year by the Japanese. Easier to do it in the UK than anywhere else, because there's not 4, 5, 6, 7 blockholders who will actually stick with the company. One of the reasons why AstraZeneca was able to fend off the bid from Pfizer was actually because it had some blockholder shareholders who actually rallied to the cause, apart from the way the Pfizer kind of misplayed their hand there. Who will be our blockholders? Who could be the blockholder shareholders in Britain? Well, pension funds and insurance companies have owned less than 10% now of shares in British companies. And It's the rest of the world that actually tends to own, and foreign asset management groups, non-UK domiciled asset management groups, that own the bulk now of the FTSE 100, indeed the FTSE 350. That's not in itself a bad thing, but it just points to the fact that how kind of dispersed our ownership base is in Britain. I've only got two or three more minutes because I want to hand over to Colin. We have a whole problem, we think, with our asset management industry. We don't think it's organized. We think it should have a dual mandate. One part of its mandate should, without doubt, of course, be rotating returns to its savers, but another part of its mandate is being a proper steward, an engaged steward, of the companies in which it invests, permitting them to look to anchored shareholders who can allow executive teams to kind of pursue a purpose over time. We also don't think that executive pay is aligned with purpose. Too much executive pay is short-term. Too much is annual bonuses or two or three-year incentive plans organized around very, very short-term time horizons for exercise of share options. And that makes it much, much tougher. You've got a very transactional shareholder base. You've got everyone look to kind of maximize kind of returns to get the share price over quarter by quarter by quarter, and that kind of gets into the incentive structure of management teams. And it just becomes difficult to actually hold that purpose over time. Who's going to kind of talk about covenants with consumers or reciprocal relation with employees or actually human betterment or innovation and investment when your back's against the wall and the incentive structure is all actually to deliver in that kind of short-term time horizon. I think this comes through. I mean, we all know the numbers, but it's worthwhile just looking at it. I mean, that black line at the bottom of that chart is business R&D as a share of GDP. And the UK has actually, in the late 1970s, actually, we weren't that bad. We've been consistently outperformed by other countries. And notice, actually, I mean, although Donald Trump wants to argue that the United States is a basket case, its business R&D as a share of GDP is twice our own. And we notice that the West Coast multinationals that have done so well over the last kind of 15 years, you know their names, all of them, one way or another, are purposed companies. And all of them have devices which allow their owners and their founders to pursue what in the terminology we call idiosyncratic value and drive forward in that way. That's not the case in the UK. So, and even when you adjust our R&D for the structure of our economy, we don't have a large manufacturing sector, which tends to be R&D intensive. Even when you adjust it, we still find ourselves towards the bottom of the class. Our stock market doesn't value intangible assets. We don't report intangible assets very, very, very well. We think one of the things that we became very concerned about was actually how kind of reports and accounts and actually what companies tell about themselves is actually not much use to an investor if you believe in purpose, an investor if you're looking for how they're innovating, what they're doing with their intangible assets. You don't even know what most companies' intangible assets are. They're not systematically benchmarked. We don't know how companies are strategically using their assets over time. And you have a kind of analog accounting system for a digital world. And we think that's another very important reason for the stock market's undervaluation intangibles and the things that makes companies grow over time. So I'm going to hand over to Colin. I think I've done it in 15 minutes. We actually think that we want it now. What do we want? We want companies to be value creators rather than value appropriators. We want a broader set of objectives to be what corporate managements go after. We want the British corporate governance system, and I think it's brilliant that so many people are in this room discussing this. I think it's one of the three or four things we've got to get right in the UK if we're going to... I'm a passionate Remainer, but if you take the view that Brexit is going to happen, it raises the stakes even more. We've got to get our firms and the architecture in which they're located more innovation and performance and purpose-oriented over time. The metrics, obviously, have got to be the ones that actually deliver what you want people to be measured on. It's how they deliver purpose. And ownership must be relational rather than transactional. If I have one thing to take away from what I've said, we want owners to own in the pursuit of purpose. Thank you very much.
Yep. Great. Okay, so there are two parts to the Purposeful Company project. The first that Will has just been talking about is looking at the evidence. Okay, one of the things that we felt was a feature of this subject is there isn't much clear evidence on what could be the underlying problem. So that's what the material that Will was talking about is trying to get towards. What's the underlying cause? The second part is to try and derive a set of policies as to what can we do about it. And we are looking at things like measurement, accounting, the role of finance, financial institutions, the incentive arrangements that exist, and executive remuneration and issues like that, and ownership. And we have a series of policy proposals that we're deriving based on this evidence as to what government, business, financial institutions can do to address the problem. Now, we can't discuss by any means all of it, but I want to just focus on one specific area that we're discussing in terms of policy ideas. How many of you here do in some form or another law or regulation as part of your course? Quite a large number, quite a large proportion. Okay, well, that's great. Because alongside economics and finance, let me just say that law and regulation really matter in this area. And one of the things that we argue has gone wrong has been the way in which we have structured our corporate law and our regulation. Why? Because the objective that we've got is to try and promote companies with purpose. And there are two ways in terms of law and regulation that one might think about doing that. The first is by having regulation that promotes purposeful companies. And the second is by having a legal system that encourages companies to have purpose. Now, in many respects, regulation often goes in exactly the opposite direction. It actually impedes companies from pursuing purpose. Because there are a variety of things that they can do to promote their purpose, to overcome the sorts of problems that Will was just talking about, insofar as we don't have owners, we have short-term investors. And we don't allow those long-term owners always to emerge. They're frequently impeded by regulation. Let me just give you some illustrations. In many countries around the world, there are things known as dual-class shares. What are dual-class shares? Dual-class shares are shares that give some shareholders more voting rights in the company than other shareholders. And, for example, in the United States, dual-class shares are commonplace. And some of the greatest companies in the world, like Google, Facebook, LinkedIn, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, they have dual-class structures. And why? Because the argument goes that the founders like Larry Page, Sergey Brin, etc., have a vision for their company and they want to retain that vision, and they don't want disinterested, short-term, institutional investors that are buying and selling to interfere with their ability to deliver on that purpose. So they retain control through having a disproportionate voting share of those companies. That's one example. Another example is that in the United States, the boards of companies can protect themselves against the risk of being taken over, in particular by hostile bidders. And they can do that through making it difficult for the acquiring company to change the boards of the firms, and they can do it through having a whole series of takeover defenses like poison pills. Now, the reason I say all of this is you can't do that in Britain. You can't do any of that. You can't be listed on the stock market with a dual-class share structure because the LSE says if you do have a dual-class structure, you can't be, quote, a premium-listed company.
That's London Stock Exchange, not London School of Economics, by the way.
Not the London School of Economics. Thank you.
I just saw one or two eyebrows going up there.
And likewise, the takeover panel says that you cannot frustrate, quote, a bid. That is to say, you cannot interfere with the takeover process once the takeover process has started. So you can't have poison pills, or you can't introduce poison pills after a bid has started. And you can't have a mechanism of staggering the changes in boards once a bid that has taken place, which is, again, commonplace in the United States. So we impede, through the regulatory process, a lot of things that in many other parts of the world, I cited the United States as an example, but actually if you go around the world, in nearly every country in the world, they have at least one of those forms of promoting purpose that I say we're not allowed to do in the UK. So that's one element. Does regulation assist with or discourage the promotion of purpose? The other is company law and the way in which company law encourages companies to behave. But before I get on to that, let me just say a little bit about regulation. Now, many of these rules that I say impede purpose have come in not because anyone's been trying to stop companies having purpose, but because they haven't recognized the impact of what they're doing. So there are very good reasons for why we discourage dual-class shares. It's a highly controversial area. And if you talk to most financial institutions in Britain, they will tell you that dual-class shares are the worst things ever invented. Okay? And there are strong arguments about them in terms of the way in which they discriminate between different classes of investors. So there are good reasons for not having them. Likewise, in terms of having takeover defences, one might want to encourage a market for corporate control and not prevent companies from being able to increase their value by being taken over by a higher value purchasing company. So in all of these areas, there were arguments for these various rules. But in many cases, the implications of this for exactly this topic of the purposeful company was not recognized. And so the principle that we put up here is that not that you should encourage companies necessarily to have dual class shares or takeover defenses, but on the other hand, you shouldn't necessarily discourage them through the types of rules that we've got. We should start from principle that we're all familiar with in relation to taxation, and that is neutrality. You shouldn't interfere. You shouldn't interfere one way or the other. You should start with a presumption that companies should be able to choose the structure that's appropriate for them. It's not to say you don't want to move away from that neutrality in some instances, but you should have a good justification for doing that. And furthermore, you should think carefully about whether or not what you're trying to achieve can be done better than through these broad brush rules that say you can't have a poison pill or you can't have a dual class structure. Think about what is the problem you're trying to solve. So in the case of dual class structures, the thing that people worry about is the fact that the minority shareholders, the people other than Larry Page and Sergey Brin in Google, can be exploited by those dominant shareholders. Well, if that's the thing you're worried about, Why not think about some direct form of protection? For example, you might seek to enhance the rights of minority shareholders, those small shareholders, in terms of major investment decisions. We use this sort of procedure in something known as related party transactions. It's a frequent way of trying to overcome the problem that exists there. There are ways in which one can focus regulation and policy on the specific problems rather than trying to have big institutional-wide rules that then have lots of unintended consequences and side effects. And to give you one illustration, to come back to what Will was talking about the collapse of institutional investors in Britain, like pension funds and life insurance companies, one of the main reasons that that has happened is regulation. Because the way in which pension funds have to value their assets is basically against government security. They discount the costs associated with their pension funds, their liabilities, in relation to a government interest rate on index-linked bonds. And that encourages those pension funds to try and match their assets and their liabilities, not by holding equity, but by holding government securities. And they've shifted in vast quantities out of equities into bonds. Now, that is an unintended consequence, and that's an illustration of how regulation can have really damaging effects in exactly this sort of area. Now, that's fine. So regulation should start off from the principle of neutrality, unless there's a good argument for the contrary, and be focused. Be focused in terms of the way in which you try and design regulation when you need to have it. But we can go further than that. We can think about, can we use law to actually promote purpose? And by promoting purpose, what I mean is, can we allow companies to structure themselves in such a way that it helps them to fulfill their purpose? And the law, and I'll say a little bit about this in just a minute, can do this in lots of different ways. In Britain, we have something known as the Companies Act, the 2006 Companies Act, and we have a very famous provision in it, a section of it called 172, which basically sets out the fiduciary responsibilities of directors of companies. Now, people frequently say that British company law is very, quote, permissive. It allows companies to basically do what they want to do. In fact, it's not in practice nearly as permissive as it's made out to be. For two reasons, one of which is the regulatory problem that I was just talking about, but also simply convention. There's a presumption that the role of directors is to uphold the interests of shareholders, and basically the way in which the law has evolved has been around that sort of notion. Although in principle you can specify a purpose under Section 172 that then lays down the fiduciary responsibilities of directors. In practice, that's very rarely done. So what we discuss in the report is, can one think of ways in which one can facilitate companies to design their structures using the existing legal framework in Britain in such a way as to facilitate the promotion of their purpose? And I just want to briefly talk about three. The notion of a public benefit company, which some of you might have come across in terms of things like the B Corp, benefit corporations, the public benefit corporation in the United States. The second is what we term the stakeholder participation company, and the third is the notion of privileged shareholder company. Now, what do I mean by these things? Basically, what we have in mind is that one can set out descriptions of different types of companies. Now, by a public benefit company, or a benefit company, as it sometimes is, what I mean is a company that states its public purpose. Okay, so its public purpose may be to promote the development of local community activities within the areas that it's operating, or it may be to address issues associated with deprivation, or it may be something much more straightforward in terms of just producing things that are of real benefit to their customers. And the public benefit company therefore has to have a stated benefit that goes beyond its commercial purpose. And then the directors have a responsibility, a fiduciary responsibility, to uphold that, quote, public benefit. Now, this is an idea that has been widely promoted in the United States in particular, and there are things called public benefit corporations that now exist in 32 states in the United States, and most significantly in Delaware. What we're suggesting is, well, we don't necessarily need to introduce a new law, as in the United States. We can think about essentially structuring models that companies might wish to adopt within the existing framework. That's one example. So another example. Theresa May, when she first got interested, having become Prime Minister, in the subject of corporate governance, latched on to the idea of, well, perhaps we ought to have workers on the boards of companies. And that's a way in which we can overcome the problems associated with disenchanted employees in firms. For a variety of reasons, she's somewhat backpedaled from that idea. But there is an important principle that the way in which our law at present protects interests other than shareholder interests is quite limited. Now, the idea of imposing a rule, as exists, for example, in Germany, that says that one should have employee representation on boards of companies, is, I think, open to question and debate. But what is less contentious is the idea that if companies believe it's in the interest of the delivery of their purpose to have employee representation on boards, or to give, as in the case of John Lewis, employees a say in the running of their company through having a council that represents employee or worker interests, so be it. Why shouldn't they be able to do that? Now, you could say, well, within the existing law, they can do it anyway. Well, that may be the case. But by setting out a model of this form, one is basically legitimizing in a way in which at present it's perhaps not legitimized to the extent that it might be. And finally, to come back to this notion of some shareholders having a long-term interest in the delivery of purpose, as in the case of Sergey Brin and Larry Page and Google, well, again, one may not want to do this through regulation, but you may want to make this permissive notion of company law more of a reality by setting out the type of model that companies might adopt to embed purpose through having these long-term engaged shareholders. Or, in terms of protecting themselves against takeovers, again, you may not want to have a universal rule, but you might want to allow companies to protect themselves, if they so wish, against takeovers. Now, this, I think, illustrates the way in which one can take a structure as it currently exists and work on it without having to fundamentally reform or throw it out, but really to appreciate that something needs to happen beyond the way in which it's currently structured. Now, there are obvious questions as to how does one determine that a company should adopt or chooses to adopt one of these structures. The answer is, clearly, it has to come with the agreement of the owners. And they ultimately have to know the type of company that they are investing in. So the basic principle here is you're engaging in activities between consenting adults. And the consenting adults, on the one hand, is the company that's setting out its purpose, and on the other hand, the investors that choose to or choose not to invest in that company. Or not just with the investors, but with your employees, who choose whether or not to work in your company, and by setting out whether you're giving them some stakeholder protection, they may find it less or more attractive to work in your firm. So this notion of being clear about what the purpose is and the way in which the company is seeking to embed that purpose in it is key to promoting the engagement of shareholders, of stakeholders alike, in the delivery of that purpose. Now, that's all fine. The question is, will companies actually do this? Will they move beyond their existing structures to adopt these types of models? And I think that's a really interesting issue, and so a lot of the other parts of the report where we're putting forward policy recommendations are really designed to complement this idea so that it's not just a legal and regulatory change that's taking place, it's in the context of a much broader change to the ecosystem of investment, incentives, etc. But I think that there are various other mechanisms that one might use to encourage companies to move in this direction. Let me take the example of the public benefit company that I was referring to earlier on. Those are companies that provide a public benefit beyond their commercial interests. We as society are deriving a benefit from those public benefit companies. Now that's, in economic parlance, an externality. Okay? And it will be underprovided in general unless one gives firms an incentive to adopt such a structure. Well, one way, obvious way in which one might think about doing that is essentially through providing a tax incentive, a corporate tax incentive, to help internalize the externality associated with the public benefit that they're conferring. And likewise, in thinking about these public benefit companies, there's one group, rather large group, of companies for whom it might be deemed appropriate to say, well, actually, this very enabling process and permissive process that I'm talking about here should have an element of compulsion in relation to at least one part of the economy. The most important part, what is sometimes termed the commanding heights of the economy, our utilities, our energy, telecoms, transport, water companies, our banks. Why? Why those companies? Because those are companies that by definition have a public purpose. That's why they're regulated. And at present what we're trying to do is to specify their public purpose as against their commercial interest just through regulation. But that creates an immense conflict because the director's duties are to their members, to their shareholders, in exactly the same way as their duties of any other company are to their shareholders. And so they seek to maximize the financial benefits at the expense of the provision of their public purpose. And those are therefore, in some respects, obvious companies to think about as ones that should be required, as part of their license condition to operate, to adopt a public benefit form. I'll stop at that point.
Thank you. Brilliant. Thank you very much, Colin. Thank you very much, Will. Some great material for us to work with in the discussion. Thank you. So now I'm going to get some panellists up on stage, and I want to spend the rest of the time we've got, just over half an hour or so, engaging with those ideas. I want to try and get some discussion and some challenge going. I'm going to bring you in. I'm sure you've got comments and questions that you want to make, and so I'm going to bring you in just a moment. But first, I want to give our panellists an opportunity to respond, to add their views, and hopefully to provide a bit of challenge to what Will and Colin have just outlined. Let me first of all, therefore, introduce you to my panel. To my immediate right is Claire Chapman. Claire is co-chair of the Purposeful Company Report Group, a non-executive director and chair of the Remuneration Committee of Kingfisher PLC. Kingfisher operates over 1,100 stores, employs 74,000 people. Claire is also on the board of Heidrick & Struggles International and serves as a commissioner on the Low Pay Commission. Next to Claire is Ian Berger. Ian is head of corporate governance at Newton Investment Management, an investment management firm with £53 billion or so under management. Ian joined the research department 18 years ago and now has overall responsibility for corporate governance considerations throughout Newton's investment process, also leads ESG analysis for certain sectors. And Ian is going to give us the investor's perspective on the panel. I hope you don't feel too outnumbered, Ian. Our final panellist to my far right is David Kershaw. David Kershaw is Professor of Law here at LSE, an acknowledged expert in corporate law and corporate governance, author of several books, including a leading textbook on company law, which some of you in the room are reading at the moment, and most recently, Principles of Takeover Regulation, published last year. He's also an outstanding teacher and PhD supervisor, and I can say the latter from personal experience because David's supervising my own doctoral studies in corporate governance here at LSE. So, first, let me start with Claire. Claire, perhaps you could help us to understand why, as chair of a remuneration committee and an NED yourself, you thought this project was a worthwhile one that you wanted to take a lead role in, and add your thoughts to those of Will and Colin. I'm also interested in your views on executive pay as a chair of a remuneration committee, so maybe you want to say something about executive pay in your introductory remarks.
Thank you very much, Simon. And can I also say, having met some of you before we started tonight, I also know there's likely to be a lot of interesting discussion from the floor as well, so I'm going to keep my conversation points very brief. But my start point, if the purpose of tonight is to talk about whether purposeful companies are a healthy prescription, my start point really is to talk about growth on the basis that if growth is the single biggest determinant of societal progress and living standards, for me it was very important as we were looking at the evidence and putting together policy recommendations that each of them would pass the test of, is this an enabler for growth? And so I want to make two observations and an assertion. And the observations I want to make are about the headwinds that I think we're facing in the UK. And therefore, the policy recommendations have got to be strong enough, have enough gun to be able to deal with those headwinds. So first of all, the first observation would be that we appear to be stuck in something of an investment paradox at the moment. If you look at companies in the UK, in the USA, in Europe, since 2008, there has been a very significant increase in the liquid holdings which are taking place in those companies, partially out of a sense of caution, but also the perceived risk and uncertainty. So what is it that's going to unlock that investment to go into igniting the sorts of growth that we're going to need to get long-term sustainable value? And I guess there's a numerous ways of looking at that. One way is to think of the things that ignite growth are big transformational events like the Industrial Revolution, like the Digital Revolution. And in a way, the best analogy I've got of that is it's a bit like surfing. You see a wave and you look to ride it, and then you do confident investment behind that. That is a worldview, but doesn't happen to be mine. My experience of having worked in very large corporations in the US, in Europe and in the UK is actually investment or growth comes from a myriad of investments, and not just in physical assets, not just in machinery and kit, but also in intellectual assets, as Will talked about, intangibles, in social assets, I met some colleagues before we started who were talking about the quality of relationships, and also with infrastructure and environment. It is very important to recognise that it's a whole series of investments in those assets, intangible and tangible, that can really ignite growth. And it's very telling for me, there was a report that's just come out of empirical findings in the US, and since the 1950s, the assertion is that about a fifth of all of the growth that's happened in the US has come from an investment in raising the educational attainments in the country. So a big investment in intangible assets can make a sizable contribution to growth. So the second headwind I want to talk about is how short-termism can be a big, big drag on growth. And Will touched on this, so I will be brief. But Andy Haldane, who's been an advisor of this work, did some work in 2014 with some colleagues and found that there were significant cases where investment in public companies was delayed or ignored to meet the short-term needs of shareholders. Now, I suspect we'll hear more about that, but as Will showed in the interim report, we showed how R&D investment in the UK is lagging elsewhere in the world. And my own view is what that points to are a whole series of changes that are needed to the ecosystem in the UK. And for me, one of the biggest single differences that could be made would be to change the accounting system in the UK. It is quite bizarre that value of firms in the UK currently is derived off largely physical assets, which in many cases is only about 50% of the value of firms. And as I pointed to earlier, it's far more other assets which are non-financial which can then lead to growth. So my own view is that we have to make sure that the policies that we put forward are strong enough to deal with the headwinds of reduced levels of investment, but also significant degrees of short-termism. And my own view, having done work on the proposals, is that it is no one single change that's going to make the difference. It's a whole bundle of changes. Colin spoke to the changes that we're going to be recommending around corporate law. And my own view is that by being able to choose a corporate form that actually matches your purpose, it will free firms up to be able to deliver against that purpose, but also with freedom comes responsibility to be able to report far more openly on the outcomes of that purpose to the public. Secondly, that as a result of the recommendations, we are going to be putting together a far more thoughtful way for firms to be able to certify that their words and their actions match. And I do think that one of the things that will do is contribute more to the license to operate. The recommendation to extend accounting to be able to take into account intangible assets and purpose. One of the benefits of that is it will result in much richer dialogue with shareholders and actually far better problem solving and resilience and adaptiveness, because of course better listening to shareholders and responding to the needs is actually a great way of being able to manage risk. And you talked about executive remuneration. Being on a remuneration committee, I do know that reducing the focus on short-term bonuses and pushing out vesting periods to 5 to 7 years to make sure that it really is the long-term that's being rewarded is a very significant move, as too is the requirement to actually hold on to shares after someone leaves an organisation. So again, it really is the long-term value creation that makes the difference. Colin talked about the fact that part one that Will talked about was the evidence report. We're just about to publish the policy report. Then comes a whole third phase, which is about making change happen. And my strong hope is that we'll be able to engage people like yourselves, because there's an awful lot of design work to do in order that this actually becomes a reality in Britain.
Thank you very much, Claire. So now we come to Ian. Ian, you're the first speaker this evening who hasn't had anything to do with this report. So I'm really interested to hear, as an investor coming to this relatively new, how Newton reacts to this? Do you think some of these proposals are workable? How would you as an investor respond if some of these proposals were to be implemented?
Yeah. I am slightly in a minority, or a complete minority here. So I'll just qualify, my statements are coming from an investor's perspective. Not all investors are created equal. Newton is a long-term, long-only investor. We invest globally. We're active. We don't follow indexes, and we don't pretend to be an index investor or an active investor that follows indexes. So we also consider ourselves to be good stewards. Like, there's a number of us in the city, I'm based over essentially about a mile away from here, that we consider ourselves to be good stewards. We engage with our investee companies. We exercise our voting rights. We try to hold companies to account for their purpose, let's say. So I've been around at Newton for 18 years, doing governance for all that time, also a little bit of what we call ENS, so the environmental and social, which falls under ESG. So I've been doing that also, and one of the things that I've been noticing really over the last few years is the propensity to change and the appetite for change amongst the investment community. So things like, I suppose, diversity probably started and lit the paper back in sort of 2010. Investors really did start to kind of think a little bit more outside of the box, looking at the intangibles, looking at things like human capital. Companies forever telling us that their employees are their biggest asset. But that's all they tell us. They don't go into any details. How do they value that asset? How do they manage it? And how should we as investors interpret that asset? Remuneration, big innovations going on. We've been talking about it pre-May's comments, and there's lots of appetite out there for significant levels of change. It requires, for change to come about, it requires companies to be innovative. Companies have been burnt recently, so there's less opportunity, less excitement amongst the corporates to really come up with something innovative if they're going to get knocked down by the shareholders through the vote, assuming we have one share, one vote. An interesting concept, and happy to talk more on the one share, one vote side of the dual class voting structures. Fundamentally, we're really focusing, for us at Newton, we're focusing on the culture. We meet with the management. We like to sit opposite, across the table from them, see the whites of the eyes. One of the key areas of conviction for us as an investor is trust. Trust in the management that they're going to protect our clients' value. We don't have any money. It's our clients' money. That's what we're investing for. We're investing for people, for pension funds, where the man walking the street is the lady walking the street is the member, and that's whose money we're looking after, and that's whose money we should always be considering when we're investing. And kind of on that point, to say, as an institutional investor, we're the servants of the asset managers, not trying to pass blame at all or pass any bucks, but if our clients are going to tell us to jump, we either say, no, we're not going to jump, and we walk away and we go into a different room, or we say, oh, how high do you want us to jump? If they're going to come to us and ask us more and more so about investing in companies that have a purpose, that look after the intangibles, we're going to do more about it as a collective investor voice. We're not hearing that to a massive sort of level of volume yet. It's increasing. There needs to be something happen. And we're seeing things happening that will increase the volume of that voice from the asset owners who provide us with the capital to invest for them. So what I suppose fundamentally saying is we're in an area of change. We're definitely, within the last 18 years, have not seen the potential that kind of lies in that. If I could just come back on a couple of points around blockholders. So I think, Will, you were talking about blockholders. One of the things in the UK, I'm a part of a group, there's 20 of us institutional investors within a group that may, under the radar, be considered to be a block holder. For instance, so within that group, there's JP Morgan, there's BlackRock. May not be considered UK investors, UK domiciled investors, but we get together with the 20 of us. We're called the Corporate Governance Forum. We're not official. We operate within regulatory bounds, of course, but we get together on at least a monthly basis to talk about companies that we're invested in, to try and give that that sort of cohesive voice to the corporates. Maybe that block holder scenario is not necessarily appreciated in the chart that you showed. I could be a lot more controversial. Within the paper, there's 21 options or recommendations, I think that's the term. I'm happy to talk about any of them if anybody's read the paper. I have some views.
Thank you. Well, perhaps we'll come back to some of those views in just a moment. I just want to bring David in, and David, we'll open this up to the floor in just a moment, but maybe you could give some of your reactions, and in particular, perhaps on the legal and regulatory side, the extent to which you think some of this is going to work.
Well, maybe given time, I should sort of get the conversation going, into the conversation between the panellists, and then to be able to open it up, so I'll be very brief. So I think it's a fantastic report. I think you're putting this issue on the map like no one has done for... actually, since you did it last time, Will, at the end of the 1990s, but I think my real concern with this project is that you're doing way too much. You're doing too much, and that risks, therefore, achieving, I think, too little. You're covering ownership structures, legal ecosystem, executive remuneration, asset management, accounting regulation. And in each one of those areas, you're going to face enormous legal, regulatory, and policy battles. So for me, the question is, why aren't you focusing on what matters the most to the exclusion of pretty much everything else? And what matters the most, I think, is what Colin focused heavily on in his comments, which is the legal ecosystem. We have a legal ecosystem in the UK that could not be more poorly suited to facilitating a purposive company on pretty much every front. Strong mandatory removal rights, strong mandatory approval rights, takeover defence regulation that prevents the use of takeover defences. We could go on. And what you need to facilitate that ecostructure is a paradigm shift in UK company law. It's a profound shift that runs against decades of ideas about how to regulate corporations, about the importance of accountability, about rationally apathetic shareholders that we need to protect, about ideas about how the UK has the best corporate law that we sell to the rest of the world. You're running up against all these things. There's a major battle. So my question to you is, why not just focus on that? Because that matters more than anything else.
So hold that, and I want to come back to that, but I do want to try. I'm going to hold you here until about 8:05, if you don't mind. We started 10 minutes late, so we'll run through until 8:05, if that's okay. And I do want to try and bring in some thoughts from the floor before we put that back. So let's take two or three questions, and I can see three hands up straight away. So there's a gentleman here, a gentleman here, and a gentleman here. If we could take those three, come to this one first, please. And then if there's time, we'll come back, and I hope there will be time to have some more. Yes.
Good evening. I'm Stephen Hockman. Very, very important work. Unfinished business following the end of the Blair regime, and undoubtedly key to the revival of the centre-left, if that's ever going to happen. But I very much agree with what Professor Kershaw said, and let me make it very even more specific with this question. If the public benefit idea is ever going to succeed, isn't it absolutely necessary, I think that's what Professor Kershaw was saying, for there to be a change in the law so that there is some sort of duty on the company itself and on its directors to benefit external stakeholders, which is enforceable by those stakeholders? Can you avoid that revolutionary measure? Can you square that circle if what you propose is really going to be achieved? Can it really be done simply in a permissive sort of way?
Thank you. And if we had another question here, please.
Actually, I'd like to take on Professor Kershaw. I should say I'm a partner of Linklaters, the law firm, and a member of the takeover panel, as it happens. I disagree that the law is the problem. In fact, I think Professor Mayer, having said the law's the problem, demonstrated it wasn't the problem. Because, number one, you can have dual classes of shares. It's the investors who don't like the dual classes of shares. Number two, you can have takeover defences. The takeover panel doesn't say you can't. It just says shareholders have to approve them, and they won't. A purpose of companies. You can have purposes companies, but actually people don't. What we're dealing with here is not a legal problem, it is a cultural problem. Now, you can encourage things, and that last slide about tax incentives, etc., is clearly very important, though I note that the point about banks, utilities and companies actually is a total foreign body in the proposals, because it's not to do with innovation at all. But what you've got to talk about is how you change that culture. It's not about changing the law at all.
Thank you. And Ewan here. Yes.
Thanks very much. Ewan McGahey, King's College London. Fascinating discussion. I noticed that we've got people on the stage from Oxford University and the London School of Economics. And so that leads to the question of stakeholder involvement. In the Oxford University Act of 1854, a mandatory rule, it said that the staff of the university had to have a vote in the university's governance, and students do as well, so that's a bit like consumers. The Memorandum and Articles of Association of the London School of Economics do the same, so employees get a vote, so do students. In the governance structure of the university. And I think that you'd agree that these are reasonably innovative, long-term thinking, successful corporations. So if mandatory regulation works for universities, why wouldn't it work for the rest of the companies in the UK?
Thank you. And yes.
Yes, thanks. I just wanted to build on the point about culture. Also a Bristol alum, not just Bristol on the stage up there. Sorry, not just Oxford. So the point about culture, I think what I took away from the first bit, this was Will talking, was, you know, this is tremendously a tremendously optimistic view. This is absolutely fabulous, which says actually there is complete consistency between purpose, yeah, which has all that, those moral implications, and actually doing well. That's what you showed. That's what the charts, that was what the story is, yeah? I then lost the story slightly because we then seem to be saying that we need to regulate people to do something which is actually in their interest. So shouldn't we be emphasising, as the gentleman said, culture or information or explaining and telling people that the good news is actually they can do good and benefit from it, yeah? There is no conflict. I think one of the challenges, one of the reasons that hasn't happened is because I think it is quite difficult to tell the purpose story and then to tell how you're doing against it. So again, it's the vision and the action against the vision. And I think part of that is because we haven't become sophisticated enough in terms of our taxonomy or that we explain what purpose is. You know, we talk about moral language. Well, that's a little bit vague, if you don't mind me saying so. Yeah? So can we focus perhaps what we'll think about a language, which a common language, which allows us to explain what that is. Yeah, and just a suggestion, you know, Davos has been full of the Sustainable Development Goals. Yeah, that's something signed up to by 190 countries. That might be a taxonomy that we could latch onto and encourage people to explain their social purpose against, and then that would be common. That's one thing. And the second thing, very much agree with Claire, I think it was you said it, is some form of consensus on the way we report against how we do against that purpose. Obviously not enough to do just to state it, you have to then report against it. So I would emphasize, I think having a transactional market is absolutely fabulous, but let's match it with strong information flows, and let's help those information flows be strong by providing the structure and the basis of the conversation.
Thank you very much. So some four really interesting points there. Claire, do you want to pick up on some of those?
I will do. You know, one of the interesting things for me in the Purposeful Company Task Force is there are genuinely representatives from the entire value chain around the table. What became very, very obvious from the first meetings is that there is no one silver bullet like change corporate law. or change this element of technical machinery. The reality is there are a number of things that need to happen in terms of the behaviour of firms, the behaviour of investors, the behaviours of regulators in order that this works. And I totally agree with the gentleman from Linklaters. Sorry, your name? From Richard's point, from Linklaters, about the fact that this is cultural. And an example for me would be, I know, working in the corporate side of the equation, that if you change the company law, of sure that will be interesting, but would it really change day-to-day behaviour? I doubt it, unless there are all sorts of other things which go along with it. So for me, one of the things that will make a big difference is changing the accounting system, is changing the way that we can do stakeholder reporting, so we can have the right dialogue with investors, where we can give them information, give employees information, suppliers information, on things that matter to them, as opposed to things that used to matter at the time of the Industrial Revolution in terms of physical assets. Ewan, your point about mandatory. What I do suspect we will end up recommending as part of the report is to make it mandatory that firms incorporate their purpose in their articles of association. Why? Because in a way, it's back to the cultural point, one of the things it therefore requires is that companies have the discussion on what do we stand for, what is our role of the world, and how are we going to express that in the way that we go about our business. So in the same way that I don't think it's just corporate law, I also don't think it's just permissiveness. I also think you're likely to see some recommendations in there which have some elements of mandatory as well.
Thank you. I want to bring Ian back in and then I'll come back to David as well. But Ian, there's a bit of a disagreement as to how much law and regulation, the role that plays and how much of it's institutional culture. I mean, do you sense amongst your clients that you alluded to the fact that you didn't think there was a big clamour for change. Do you think that there's a problem culturally with some of the institutional investors in the country that's going to prevent some of this stuff from ever really from ever really being properly implemented?
A cultural conflict.
I mean, what
I think there are elements of conflict that exist within investors that will prevent them from accepting more change or accepting change. I think these things can always be overcome. And I think there is a cultural mindset change. There's a new generation of investors coming through. There's greater pressures. There's economic advantages to be had through recognising and understanding sort of cultural differences, and when investing, you're not purely investing with an open book to say, we'll give any company your money and hope that they're going to provide a return. There's a massive amount of anecdotal and empirical research out there. We do our own internal research that proves that the work we do from an environmental, a social and a governance perspective, which some class as non-financial, actually provides added level of return for our clients. We can prove it internally. I wouldn't be working if it wasn't for the fact I'm providing a return. I think that it can be achieved. Any cultural change is always a slow process. Things can be escalated to increase the level of change and the speed of change. And it would be great to see it. I think it can happen. In terms of, I think it was Ewan, was it? You know? Yeah, and the kind of the mandatory governance side of things. I think yes, mandatory governance. One has to be careful. It works. Specific examples work for specific companies or bodies in their unique environment. I think one has to be sort of very careful of applying very specific requirements on a very broad set of companies. the comply or explain approach in the UK has worked, arguably has worked really well. More companies comply with the governance requirements than necessarily explain. As an investor, I much prefer companies to explain. If they've explained why they don't comply, that means they've given it a greater level of, in my view, they've given it a greater level of thought that has gone into that decision. And obviously, there are a lot of investors that don't, and a lot of companies have to toe the line, let's say, otherwise they get a big vote against.
So that sort of goes back to these sort of ingrained institutional attitudes. David, can I come to you? So the challenge is the law is already pretty permissive and there's just no demand for this kind of diversity of structures.
No demand from shareholders, right? The law is not permissive for shareholders to choose a different balance of power that they think could facilitate a different type of company that could ultimately generate more value. And I think the scope to choose to elect to have a different balance of power to facilitate that is something that's missing. And I don't really get it in the debate in the United Kingdom because we're very heavily focused on shareholder sovereignty, shareholder choice. And what UK company law does is take away choice. You can't have a different removal right. It does take away choice. It does take away choice. You cannot choose to empower your directors to use takeover defences without your approval subsequently. It is not wrong. The non-frustration rule requires, when a bid is made, that you go back to your shareholders for approval. You cannot ex ante give your directors the power to use a takeover defence without then going back to your shareholders once a bid is commenced. You cannot, in UK company law, provide for a removal right that is a cause removal right. You cannot, in UK company law, take away the requirement to go to your shareholders if you enter into a significant transaction worth more than 25% of the company. You cannot just completely, in a public company, very easily waive preemption rights permanently. Okay, there are many, many things that you simply cannot do. It is not permissive. We probably need to take this up afterwards. I don't want to take away too much of Will. But anyway, so the point is...
I'm very happy It's very interesting. I'm fascinated by the discussion. I want to hear the reply.
I should be quiet, Lydia. We've only got 5 minutes.
So thank you. So I'm just going to see if there are any other comments from the floor which we can just briefly take. And I'm afraid I'm only going to have time for two or three more. So I'm going to go down the middle here to the lady with her hand up and then the gentleman in front of her, if I may. And then I'll just take one more over here, please. Thank you.
Hi. So you mentioned earlier about the study from Bob Eccles at Harvard. I actually work with Bob and I work with George Seraphim at Harvard University. And they've done incredible work demonstrating the value of purpose and how it actually leads to improved profits. And I think that it's incredibly important. At the end of the day, companies are there to make a profit, and if we can kind of continue educating on exactly how that works in practice for companies to show that they derive value from purpose, not just that they have a purpose, but that it creates a value in some way.
Then more evidence.
Exactly. And, for example, that could be employees deciding to work harder because they're engaged with a purpose and they see value in what they do. There's also multiple ways for companies to actually go about putting purpose into practice in their company. They can do it by aligning their strategy, the overall company strategy, with their purpose. They can do it through certification, such as the B Corp certification, or they could do it through changes in company law. And each of those decisions has different levels of risk, different levels of uncertainty, but each of them provides a way to do it in practice. And my final comment would just be to ask about the community interest company in the UK, which is actually a legal, a corporate form which already exists that hasn't been mentioned yet.
Yes.
And if you have any thoughts on that.
Thank you. Yes, that's a very good point. And the gentleman in front of you, please.
Hi, my name's Daryl. I'm from B Lab UK, the non-profit behind the B Corp movement. Thank you very much for an excellent discussion, first off. I'm just wondering, in regards to, you know, obviously we discussed mandatory regulation and how that might not necessarily work, but equally that opting in, like we do with the B Corp certification, you end up with an echo chamber of lots of companies who all believe in the same thing. And so the question, I guess, then becomes, well, do we need a cultural change? And I think, and what we're seeing is that many studies show that that's happening with the rise in the number of millennials as consumers, as workers, as investors, and the impact they're having. And I was wondering if there'd been any thought into the role that they're going to be playing going forward.
Thank you. And final comment here.
Yeah, Darren Kiggins, NAPO rep. Can I just ask, you spoke about, you've approached the government on having representation on boards of companies, and I get the impression that they're now coming back with slightly cold feet, a possible another U-turn. Perhaps, is there any sort of any information as to why that would be the case? Because I believe it works very well in Germany. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for those comments. I'm going to ask Will and Colin to perhaps have the last word, and specifically to pick up on those three points. So did you look at community interest companies, and what do you think of them? Do you think that there is a change in culture that's perhaps coming through with a new generation that's going to drive some of this change? And you don't, I think, well, at least you haven't published your final report yet, so we don't know, but you didn't seem to be going in the direction of actually mandating employee representatives on board, and I just wondered whether there was a reason for that. I'm going to have to ask you to be brief, but if you could try and deal with those.
We did publish in November an interim report on pay, and we did argue for a what we call a fair pay review or a fair pay charter in which directors and chairs of REMCOMs have to engage in, and directors' team more widely, a dialogue with staff and union representatives about pay relativities, whether pay is deserved, how pay serves the delivery of purpose, and what is happening to pay ratios over time. And the reason why we think that works better is because, I mean, I did, in the state we're in, float the idea of supervisory boards, Germany style. I don't think it's ever going to happen in Britain. You know, now I'm in my 60s, and I've got to a point where I think, let's do what's feasible. And I do think in a unitary board, where you try to proceed by unanimity, it is quite tricky having a kind of a stakeholder who is likely to take an oppositional role, and it's going to be difficult for that stakeholder too, by the way. How do you choose them? How do they have legitimacy? This fair pay review and a fair pay charter, a mandatory requirement to pick up someone else, are we going to be mandatory? A mandatory requirement on every company, public or private, to engage in this process would, I think, be one trigger amongst the others, to pick up on David's point and to reinforce what Claire said, that would deliver cumulative change, because what you want in the end is culture change. I mean, if you think about change, well, 30 more seconds, whether it be wearing seat belts in cars, whether it be when it was first established that smoking caused cancer, there was enormous resistance to that idea, and we've now got to a place where it is culturally kind of impossible to kind of smoke in a private place, or a public place almost now, and actually that's become backed by law. And what we've got to do, and what I want to do with this report and Claire and kind of fantastic kind of, where, you know, it's a fantastic group we put together on the steering group and actually the companies that support us, and we've is to try to deliver something that will trigger a conversation that will enable the cultural change behind which legislators can actually come in behind to transform the regulatory and legal architecture. That's the long-term aim. But it's a generational long thing to do, and many of the people in this audience who are under 35 are going to be the people who will carry the flag when I'm pushing up daisies.
Okay. Just very quickly, the three questions. First of all, community interest companies. Yes, We have considered community interest companies. They are important, but they operate at a very small scale. They do exactly what they say they do in terms of trying to promote local community interests in certain activities. They differ in that regard from the benefit corporation, which is seeking to essentially create a broader public benefit. Will millennials play an important role? Absolutely. I mean, in essence, what we've seen going on because of our dysfunctional corporate structure, that there's been essentially a theft by current generations of capitalizing on assets at the expense of future generations. And that's exactly what you generation need to really react against, and that's why this issue is of such importance to you.
Right.
Just very quickly, German supervisory boards, in essence, some of our most successful companies, just think about John Lewis. What does John Lewis have? It has a council of employees that essentially performs that sort of oversight and stewardship function. So it isn't a model that we're going to adopt wholeheartedly in the UK, but there are certainly elements of it that should be featuring in our governance going forward.
Thank you. Okay, so thank you very much for staying until 8:10. Before I go, I have to tell you briefly about two other forthcoming public events that LSE Law are holding in the coming months. First, on the 6th of February, we've got a panel discussion on whether time limitations should be applied to criminal law in an event called Stale Crimes. And then on the 13th of March, Nicola Lacey will be in conversation with Baroness Shami Chakrabarti, discussing her position as Shadow Attorney General. Please do try and join us for one of those. Finally, you'll probably see some people shaking buckets on the way out if they haven't given up and gone home. They're collecting for RAG Week, so good causes. Please dig deep. It only remains for me to say thank you very much for joining us this evening.